You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Gaudette. Yesterday, protests were again held across the United States over the death of George Floyd, an unarmed Black man who died in police custody in Minneapolis last Monday. All four officers involved were white, and they were fired after that killing. And one former officer has now been charged with third-degree murder and manslaughter, but many people believe the charge isn't harsh enough and that the others involved should also be arrested and charged. And then yesterday, President Trump vowed to use military force if violence among some protesters isn't stopped. Shortly after making that statement, peaceful protesters were hit with tear gas by police so the president could get through for a photo op at a church across the street from the White House. The footage from his visit was later posted by the official White House Twitter account. And as we all know, this is not the first time in the United States that an unarmed Black person has been killed at the hands of police. And it is not the first time protests have broken out. So here is the question. Will this time finally be different? Will calls to confront systemic racism be heard? And how will Idaho, an overwhelmingly white state with its own problems and its own history of racism, react? Joining us today to talk more about this is director of the Idaho Black History Museum, Philip Thompson, and retired Idaho State Senator Sheree Buckner-Webb. Welcome to the program, both of you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you kindly.
You know, and we should note that the two of you are mother and son, for people who don't know that. You know, as I said in the introduction, this is not the first time that there have been high-profile killings of Black men in particular by police in America. Why do you believe that this time may be different? I mean, what was it that made people of color say, you know what, no more? And Philip, maybe I'll start with you.
I think first and foremost was the ease at which the officer did so. You often hear the rationalization that I feared for my life is why I accidentally took this gentleman's life. It was not intentional, but I was fearful for my own. But you can see in the film that there was no imminent threat. The gentleman was handcuffed. He was lying down and peacefully, politely saying, I cannot breathe. And the gentleman, without emotion whatsoever, was okay with keeping his life, his knee on his neck and his life in peril, and did nothing to resolve the situation. And this comes on the heels of a gentleman running through a neighborhood, looking at a house, two men literally vigilante style, stalk him, hunt him, kill him. And it goes covered up by the legal system that's supposed to protect us in that same city for months. And then on the heels of that, when you are protesting what was done, police brutality, deaths that are unreasonable, Blacks are faced with more police brutality while they protest police brutality in Minnesota, whereas unarmed Black protesters are met with police brutality, armaments, and tear gas. When white protesters protesting something as simple as a stay-at-home order for the benefit of the entire community, protest with guns, scream in the face of police officers, constantly threaten violence, are met with, hey, it's their constitutional right, it's okay. But then when Blacks even just speak out of turn, your answer is brutality and to brutalize them. This was all in the midst of a month where everyone is at home seeing these images again and again and again, in a heightened state of anxiety, uncertainty, and fear in the face of a pandemic. The boiling point has been hit, and you're just seeing the outward effects of that frustration and the endless brutality that our community faces.
And Senator, I think something that Philip said, you know, so much of it resonated, but how much of this does go back to these images we have seen of almost solely white Americans, you know, protesting the stay-home order with, you know, with guns, yelling, screaming in the face of police officers, and nothing happens?
Well, I would tell you from my vantage point of some 60-some years that this is not a new narrative. This has been going on year after year after year. My parents faced it. My grandparents faced it. That we're talking about a microcosm of what's been going on for time almost immemorial in the United States for Black Americans. And there comes a point where you just overflow when you when we've seen the race riots, when we've seen lots of things happen. How long can folks sit idly by and just succumb to whatever a larger society wants to dish out on you?
And Senator, your family has been in Idaho for seven generations. What was your experience like growing up here in Idaho?
Well, you know, one of the things that didn't change at all from my generation, my father's generation, onto my granddaughter's generation, the message we got always, I got it from both sides of my family, because not only my grandmother, my dad's side, and my mom's side were both here, was you've got to behave better. You've got to work harder to be considered half as good. When somebody steps on your toes, you have to turn the other cheek. We were told that we were at peril all the time. And you would think, because we're such a minority part of the population, that such a small minority, that how much trouble could you get into? But we found, even as children, that we were treated differently for acting the same as our colleagues. We could not smart mouth. We could not play hooky. We could not do a lot of things because the repercussions were much more for children of color.
Philip, do you think anything has changed from what your mom just talked about to you growing up here?
So my mother gave me the same playbook as a child. So this is all I know. This is my existence. I've lived elsewhere, but majority I lived here. So my mother always told me, first and foremost, you have to be twice as good to be considered half as good. She forbade us from wearing jeans with holes in them, a shirt that could be seen as confrontational or controversial, other than like Black revolutionary thought. There was no gangster rap images allowed on shirts. There was no, we were unable to speak anything other than the King's English as articulately as possible, be well read. You were not getting anything less in the school than a B, because in order to thrive, you better be better than 90% of the majority. And even when you are doing so, you are not going to be seen as an equal. I have a 9-year-old daughter who she hears the exact same thing from me. And I think it's actually more so pervasive now because it's done under the guise of we're trying to help you. It's so quiet. Mm-hmm. You see the blowback as far as our state's laws have gone, as far as pulling back civil rights protections, other political moves that kind of go to that much more extreme, unnecessary narrative, but we're still seeing it time and time again. So I don't know that it's changed. I think the wolf has found different clothing, but it's still a problem. I would never operate under the pretense that I'm going to be treated equally, or even my daughter being treated equally as mainstream dominant culture as a Black American.
And I will tell you, even during my tenure as a senator, and by the way, I'm still in until the end of November, so I have to still own that, and I'm glad to own that, proud to own that. I hear from families that do the same thing as their next door neighbors, but it's considered inappropriate. We don't want them in our neighborhood. If you put up symbols that are important to you, we see that from people that worship in a different way, that they have church in a different, Muslims aren't, what are they doing? What are they doing on Friday? Why aren't they doing on Sunday? The things are still perpetuated even today. I think there's lots of people with good intention. I believe there are a lot of people that are working hard, but I'm telling you that the stereotypes, myths still persist. Children in school that are maybe acting in a certain way, kind of maybe rowdy, immediately it's a problem. It's an innate problem with that child. Not that it's an 8-year-old boy that likes to be busy all the time, but there's always, there's some kind of a pathology attached to certain behaviors with Black youth.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Idaho State Senator Sheree Buckner Webb and Philip Thompson. He is the executive director of the Idaho Black History Museum. I want to talk a little bit more about police and criminal justice, because do you believe that the system itself is broken? And if so, I mean, how in the world do we fix it? Because there seems to be a cultural issue within many police forces.
I'm going to go first because I think Philip's probably got a lot more to say about that, because my interaction with the police has been pretty limited. And fortunately, I have had issues that, particularly in issues of domestic violence, the folks make an assumption about a Black woman. She probably did something that she deserves it, or Black folks don't get along anyway. And that's how you people, and we still get that kind of language, you people. I will tell you, I don't see that much in Boise as I do in other other places that I travel, other organizations in which I participate, our interaction with the police is still quite difficult. I love Boise. Boise is heads and shoulders above some of the work that I see in my social work background and in my organizational development background where I'm traveling around the United States. But there's still work to be done. I'll let you take it, Philip.
So I think that Boise, and I'm going to speak to Boise's issue for the most part, and then we'll compare it to the nation, because we're so unique. Part of the things that you'll see here is we still have, statistically, we were just working with Ada County Sheriff regarding this issue, and part of a MacArthur grant, that we still have disparities in comparison to the demographics of Boise, Idaho, and Ada County, that you have overrepresentation by Blacks in particular in Ada County. It's not as pervasive as a problem as you will see nationwide, and you don't have the acts of police brutality, reports of misconduct, things in that regard. But as far as stop rates, driving while Black, the moment that you're introduced to the criminal justice system for the exact same charge, the outcomes regarding successful probation, regarding which time, how much you're assigned a fine or how much time you have to serve, there's a gross disparities there.
Young Black men in particular.
For example, refugee groups are underrepresented in the Idaho criminal justice system unless they're Black. So those type of things are still an issue, but I'm not saying that to vilify or accuse Ada County Sheriff or Boise Police, because they've been exemplary as far as law enforcement go. They have made a concerted effort to keep doors of communication constantly open with the Black community. And when I say the Black community, I mean African diaspora, I mean first generation Blacks, I mean Black Americans, descendants of former slaves, through a myriad of ways, whether it be communication through the mosque, whether it be communication through the NAACP, whether it be communication through the Idaho Black History Museum. They have gone above and beyond to make for certain that there is a liaison, a relationship, an easy mode of contact and open discussion with them to get ahead of these problems before they start.
And if I can interject this, we have to remember that many people are not natives of Idaho. Many are the first to come to Idaho. And you say, no, you're less than 1% of the population. And that's after I've talked to grandmothers, cousins, others that say, please look out for my kid if I'm going to let him even come to school there. Folks, when a policeman comes up behind you, I don't care what color you are, people, you sweaty, your palms get sweaty and that kind of thing. And you do answer differently. And sometimes, I mean, things come across differently. But when Black kids are know that they're at a minimum, Black adults, Black people, anything can be perceived as wrong.
And
we're as a threat, mm-hmm. the way we move, the way we look, if we have, can I'm reaching over to get something for my baby. We know that Black folks are often, well, they made a move that was threatening or whatever. So there's this double whammy. People don't know what they don't know. And you do act differently when a policeman stops you. You do. I mean, that you're innocent as the day is long.
Right.
You do. You know, get nervous.
One thing that I have noticed that seems to be different this time is that we have seen police officers, like in particular in Flint, Michigan, we've seen some in parts of, you know, Southern California, I mean, places all over the country where police officers are literally taking off their helmets. They are talking, not just directly with the protesters, they are joining in. We've not seen
Hallelujah.
Before, right? Right?
How they're making relationships with communities.
And that's what I'm wondering is, what is it about this moment that is waking more people up, I guess, Senator?
Well, I don't know what it is. I'm grateful for whatever it is, and I hope that it spreads like wildfire. I mean, I've got to say, in the Black community, folks are timid to buy it. They want to make sure, is this for real? And they want to see it. They want to see it more than once and twice. I'm not going to pat you on the back for being civil to me one time. But I think that it works both ways. But it takes work. It takes work. It takes work. And it takes continuity.
And the precipitator, in my opinion, is simply, okay, and I'm not going to, like, again, I will not vilify an entire group of people, meaning all police are bad, when there's an accidental shooting that you may have been afraid for your life. I understand that. But I think it was so painfully obvious that even those who have accidentally shot somebody because they were wrongfully overly afraid and need not be, there is no police officer who's going to objectively look at a man who is handcuffed on his chest with your knee in his neck because the threat has been neutralized. And the gentleman's politely saying, "I can't breathe." And the sheer lack of emotionality on the gentleman's face.
Falling on his
and
mama.
Three and four other people standing idly by, not just even discreetly saying, "Hey, we got the suspect, we're good," or "Hey, I'll take it from here," because there's some culpability there. The other three people that were idly standing by watching it happen, that they know that this is a poor reflection on their institution. So to stand up and not be held accountable and say, "Hey, we're in agreement that this is incorrect and wrong and this shall not and should not happen," that also puts them in harm's way. So I applaud them for doing so. And I think the reason is because it was so painfully obvious that there was not a sense of fear. There was no threat. There was no reason for that to continue. And the gentleman conducted himself, meaning the gentleman who has lost his life, in a way to say, "Hey, I'm simply trying to survive." And the cop showed absolutely no compassion to take his life as valuable.
My grandmother Johnson used to say, one of the things we wish, and she's been dead a long, long time, and she lived to be 86 years old. She said, "We need people to see me as Pearl, to see me as a person, not that black woman, not that black man, not that black, but as a person. If you could honor my personhood, that's the first step."
You know, I want to take a minute and talk about reactions by white people saying that racism in America is getting worse. But the actor Will Smith back in 2016 said the following: "Racism isn't getting worse, it's getting filmed."
And I just think that, honest to goodness, and I'm not going to assume that everybody who comes with the defense that it's not that bad is nefarious nor ill-intended as far as their, you know, dissertation on race relations in America. But what I think is the contradiction of experience is truly based on ignorance. I mean, I've grown up in Boise, Idaho. So even my level of animus that I would encounter on the daily is going to be nowhere near the vast majority of the animosity that black people would face anywhere, even in a society that's majoritarily black or has a much more significant black population than we have here. So I really believe that the notion of, "Oh, it's getting worse," is truly because for many cases, they really believed that we were exaggerating or that can't possibly be true, or "I've never seen a police officer do that where I live, so how would they possibly be that much different where you live?" And until we had the invention of these beautiful things known as smartphones, that it put such a glaring light in the dark so that we can now see what's going on, when up until then, it was always like, "Well, why come I'm not seeing it? Prove it to me, show me some data, show me some evidence." Now the evidence is so overwhelming, you can't but accept that, oh my God, what they've been telling us for four decades is true.
You know, as a white woman myself, you know, I live in the privilege of being white. No matter how hard my life has been, no matter what, you know, what has come my way, I mean, the one thing that has not made my life harder is the color of my skin. And I think that sometimes it's a very difficult conversation and uncomfortable as white people to have these conversations, right? And so then a lot of people become defensive, not all people, some. So Philip, why do you think it's important that we have to stop thinking about this just on an individual level? I mean, what do you hope your white neighbors here in Idaho will do now, maybe do differently, you know, step up, speak out? What should we be doing?
It's multidimensional. I mean, number one, the acknowledgments helps first and foremost, but then be open to the notion and a realization that this is not as simple as you being kind to a given person. Because right. Yes, that's the first start. Treat them like a human first and foremost, but there is an entire underpinning or underlying system that creates this notion of haves and have-nots that make the disparity wider, the gap harder, and the achievement level lesser, that we need to actually approach from a systemic level in addition to the interpersonal connections. So you have to understand that what you just said. I mean, let's think about like wealth disparities. GI Bill was not afforded to black people. was afforded to white people. And that's, for the most part, the basis for generational wealth. So you cannot pass it down to your grandchildren or your children. So you have this growing wealth gap since World War II, because grandpa came home, bought a house, gave it to his kids, or sold it and gave the money to his kids. You have two and three generations of that. The wealth gap is amazing. Those simple things, those wealth gaps feed into the schools that your kids go to. So if you're going to an area where the school is underfunded as opposed to an area where the school is adequately funded, those disparities get even wider. So, I mean, there's an entire system at play that I'm not going to guilt you. You're not guilty because you're white. I'm not going to vilify you because of you being white, but you've got to be aware that we're starting off from two entirely different places for the majority, and that the road that has gotten you to where you are now is because of the labor of those that came before you, equally as such in my case, but you were able to benefit from those different points of access that allowed you to have access to things that I couldn't imagine. Even another black man, the age 43 in Boise, Idaho, who may grow up next door to me, in all likelihood, because of the generations that my family has been here, would not have the same likelihood and the ability to pick up the phone and call whatever it is they need access to, because, oh, I knew your grandfather. Oh, I know your dad. Oh yeah, we used to play ball with your uncle, in the same way that I can. So even me being a black male has to be aware of that. So if you're white, in addition to that, it's that simple. If I need to have my kid learn something about geometry, can I call somebody who can give some extra help? I've got that luxury. For many, I mean, granted, that's just a simple example, but for many, it's not there. So generations of that, your achievement gap and your access to even be able to achieve is not there. Idaho isn't so like some racial utopia that we came up with these laws to make sure that there wasn't disparities. We simply didn't put in place legislation that kept the blacks living in a given neighborhood, kept their schools disempowered economically, because we were able to go to public schools there in the early 1900s. So you didn't have the gap because our population was so small.
We didn't have it on the books, Philip, but River Street was the utopia for black folks. That was the only place we could rent or purchase. Just want to put that out there, because your grandpa was there, your grandmother, both sides of your family. Everybody thought that River Street, we wondered why they put the great big fancy new men's club there, because that was our property. But guess what? It wasn't after a while. Yeah, they did segregate us. I just want to remind you that it does show up in lots of different ways. They said, we don't think of you as black, but no, we'll rent over here, but don't you go rent out on North 19th where our folks were. And that's why there was a cross in our yard. Maybe they rented or sold to us, but the hope was that we get back where, quote, we belong.
So how tired do you get of really having to educate white people about this? And I'm guilty of it too. Like, frankly, I mean, right? Like, how... It seems like it would be exhausting.
Well, let me tell you, we have a little fun with y'all too in our own little back doors. part of the deal is how you come to me. If you come to me with zeal, not please, please educate me, and now I'll walk away and I'll know everything about every black person, because after all, you are a monolith. You're all just alike. I might lay some stuff on you and let you go look like an idiot when you walk away. I'm just trying to stay in my personhood. But one of the things that always surprises me when white people act like, well, I know you're black, or I don't think of you as black. I never see you as black. And when you tell me you don't see me as black, I think this person ain't right. And I mean, how can you look at me and not know I'm black? I say I'm black. I tell you I'm black. And by the way, I'm proud of being black. So by your diminishing me by saying I don't see it, or there's no difference, you're insulting me. Now, Philip, you may have we're a different generation here.
Yeah, and so mine, I mean, I have the luxury of, number one, that's what I do now, so it's not like a big deal. And then, so if they're not open to having the discussion and ask the question, it defeats the purpose of us even having like a Black History Museum. So I welcome it and open it, because it's every chance they do so, it's an opportunity. The fun comes as far as being aware of the divisiveness and divisiveness of language, and that when someone comes and asks a question in a given way, they're framing my answer in such a way that it's going to be conducive and they will be receptive to my answer. There's certain words that I won't use, simply because if you're center to right, if I go into that language, you're going to quit listening to me the moment I go into it. And I also am very mindful of, if I'm going to make an analogy or a comparison, using something outside of America that we kind of universally agree upon, because it doesn't hit that personal chord of this is me. And then they see the line of thinking through that by sound reasoning, they'll come to the epiphany and the idea on their own. I don't have to tell them. I simply need to lead them to it.
And the other piece of it is, the reality is, there are a lot of things that I don't know that somebody that I'm working with really believes to be true. I can remember when I went to work in the sawmills in Emmett, Idaho, and we were talking about athletes, and I know nothing. I have a father who was an athlete. I got kids that are athletes, but anybody that has ever seen me in person knows I ain't no athlete. But I will tell you that they kept saying, the reason your people are always at the top of it, you have an unfair advantage because of that extra tendon you all have.
What?
Extra tendon. It took me a while. I was there for a while because I was the only one in town. And finally I said, are you serious about that? An extra tendon? Well, yes, all you Black people have an extra tendon. And that's why we don't want to play against you, because you have an extra tendon. I will say I have used that from time to time, but there's no extra tendon, folks. There's no extra tendon. But I mean, somebody over generations has perpetuated some of those myths.
Right.
And yes, we have been strong. And yes, we have been able to do things because we were pretty manual most of our lives. I mean, if you look historically, but I'm just blown away. And much of that is not an attempt to deride or talk down to me, but they really believed it. Extra tendon.
So before I let you go, Philip, you've been very clear that no protests or rallies have been approved by your organization or by city leaders. Why is that important to note? Because also for the last couple of nights, we've seen protests in Boise, peaceful for the most part. And what honestly do you want to see happen in terms of protests or rallies? Will there be a coming together of people being able to do something that your organization can lead or numerous organizations?
And I can't help myself as his mother. I don't think there's any, it's nothing about approving them, but until you are certain who is responsible for them, there was a lot of information going out that was from Black Lives Matter and so on and so on. The person's name after Philip went through a myriad of circumstances trying to find, the person didn't even live here. Person hadn't lived here for a long time. We want to protect our community too. I'm talking about our Boise community. We didn't want to be surprised that it was troublemakers. And we also, from both sides, was it really Black Lives Matter? Was it really Black people? Was it really people with a right wing bent? We want it to be a safe demonstration and acknowledgement of what's happened.
Before I let you go, is there anything that gives you hope?
No, absolutely. I think, I mean, in order for anything, from like a manufacturing perspective, you need creative destruction, right? You have to tear down what you've been doing now in order to improve it and do it better thereafter. So I'm hoping this is our little pivotal moment as a society that, you know what, we're acknowledging we have some generational problems that need to be addressed. And we're seeing it. We're not going to debate it. We're not going to justify it. We're going to try to fix it. And this could be, and I'm not trying to sound overly optimistic, but it could be a turning point, because as you said, this is one of the first times I've seen multiple police officers from across the country come out and say, hey, we're standing with you. So those who claim to be, oh, I'm pro cop in all cases, well, the cops also want to see this resolved. So we need to have this discussion. That gives me hope, for lack of a better word, and that there are so many voices that are not the affected party that are sincerely trying to contribute.
Hope springs eternal for me. I think people are more erudite, are more willing to have conversations, are willing to risk an uncomfortable conversation. They're more learned. And the risk of not having a conversation and it not getting better is detrimental to us as a society. Yes, I have hope.
I want to thank both of you so much for taking time to talk to us today. Such important conversation to be having, and so much more we could have been talking, more broader discussion too. So much that we left on the table, but I thank you both so much for your perspective and your time. We have been talking with State Senator Sheree Buckner-Webb and Philip Thompson, the Executive Director of the Idaho Black History Museum. Thank you both so much.
Thank you, Gemma.
Thank you, ma'am.
This is Idaho Matters.